Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the Four Persons. And I got a very special guest today from the other side of the pond, so to speak. Greg Nolan. Greg, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing pretty good. Thank you for the invite. I'm looking forward to the conversation we'll have today. Yeah, thanks be to God. All's good. How's yourself?
I'm doing great. Now, you approached me on Facebook, and it just happened to be an issue that's just right up my alley, my way of thinking. And I just, God bless you. You're one of the few that I've seen that have the courage to take on a big problem in modern psychotherapy. Where a large segment of the people in that profession are kind of excluding, to borrow terminology from our name, two of the four persons, the emotional person and the spiritual person, to a very detrimental effect, right?
Yeah. To be honest, my take would be that they're not intentionally doing, it's not an intentional act. So the fathers of modern psychology, so like Freud being the sort of father of modern psychology, and then Jung and his disciples and various people, the fathers were essentially materialists, right? So they viewed the human person as being constituted by nothing other than the matter of their body, the cells of their body, neurons, neuronal activity, hormones. So they viewed the human person as nothing other than a highly evolved animal, and that the idea of a spiritual soul was the great divorce, you might say. They jettisoned the notion of a spiritual immaterial soul, especially Freud. Freud was an outspoken materialist. So I don't think that practitioners these days are maliciously trying to do something. I think they're just following on from what's been handed down for the past 100 years, you know?
Okay, fair enough. But it has had a devastating and detrimental effect. You would agree, right?
Yeah, I'd say it's largely ineffective. Like, you know, there's a proliferation of therapists and counselors, at least in the Western world, but mental disorders are on the up every year. So there's a mismatch there. If we keep on, like the British government, for example, poured hundreds of millions, perhaps billions, into training therapists over the past 10, 15 years. But mental disorders are just on the rise, essentially. So something's wrong with the picture, really. Yeah. And it's one of the things that I sort of labor the point of quite a lot are the spiritual faculties of the soul. It's mainly the spiritual immaterial reality of our soul that's just not countenanced by modern psychology at all, you know? Yeah, there's lots to say.
I've done a lot of reading in the last few years on this type of thing, and this total divorce, whether it's intentional or not, of the soul, of the psych, of the spiritual element from what is a human person. Well, when you see people do unspeakably evil things, and you don't recognize the spiritual element of a person, well, then you can't really call it evil, because evil really doesn't exist. So we have a tendency to almost use mental health to excuse behavior that's really, evil. I remember years ago, I used to have a political show, and I had a forensic psychologist on there, and we used to talk about this in the frame of the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath. And this was a very brilliant man, and he told me there's a little bit of overlap, that the circles are not clearly drawn, but that modern psychology, or a large segment of modern psychology, wants to put it all over to the the medical, physical, mental aspect, and not even consider this other aspect? And do you think that's why we've had a rise in just these horrific crimes, like school shootings, for instance? Just one example.
Oh, it's certainly one of the core. Yeah, it's all part of a bigger picture for me, to be honest. So we've gone in the 20th century from being, you know, America, the UK, we were largely a religious Christian society. We've gone from being religious to being a post-religious society. I don't know. Is this a Catholic show?
Yes. Catholic?
It is, yeah. Right. Okay.
Yes.
So Pope Benedict XVI, for example, said that 1968 was the last year of Christendom, right? We've moved into a post-Christian society. So part of the psychological divorce of the spiritual features of the soul from the material, and the jettisoning of the spiritual faculties of the soul, was part of a bigger picture of the jettisoning of God from society, right? So we've gone from being, like, at that time in the early 20th century, moral psychology had quite a strong foothold, like psychopathy. To be a psychopath, the original diagnostic name was moral insanity. That was the name of psychopathy prior to psychopaths and sociopaths coming on the scene, you know? So they viewed it in terms of moral psychology some time ago, but that's just dwindled and dwindled and dwindled. And now, for example, psychopathy is seen as what they call neurodivergent. So it's just seen as a neurochemical imbalance. It's, you know, as you say, it takes the morality out of it. That's a massive problem. That's a huge problem. If you view the human person as a highly evolved animal, and morality is just a construct. So there's so many parts involved in this. There's the philosophical schools in academia that filter down into psychology. There's the, you know, the abandonment of truth by clerics and things. There's so many parts to this. It isn't solely due to psychology by any stretch of the imagination. Psychology is just one flower of an evil root system, essentially. But yeah, the rejection of God in modern society, the view of humanity as being just a highly evolved animal that's comprised of nothing other than the flesh and skin and bones, that they, you know, the material, our material body consists of, it's all part of a bigger picture. So why are there more crimes? Because we've lost our moral compass. We've lost sight of God. We've lost, you know, we've lost our anchor to sanctifying grace. We've lost our vision of what goodness looks like. It's certainly a bigger problem than clinical psychology. It's a much bigger problem than that, you know, I would say.
Wow, this is a fascinating conversation. I've got so many questions for you. So let's decompress two things that you say here. Now, from my understanding, I'll give you my anecdotal understanding, and you tell me if I'm correct or not correct.
I'll do my best.
But my understanding of mental illness has always been a person who is not in full possession of his mental faculties, a person who has a distorted sense of reality, who can't separate reality from fantasy. For instance, a person who might kill another person because he thinks that person's a vampire or something like that. I'm using an extreme example, but that's always been my understanding of mental illness. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when a person, and I brought up school shootings, and the only reason why I know this is because I've read extensively about it, read several books about it, the Parkland shooting in Parkland, Florida in 2018. This person was methodical in how he planned this attack, how he packed the right weapon and the right armaments, how he knew his entry point, how he knew how he was going to get in and get out, blend in with the crowd. And the way that he went through this school from top to bottom was methodical. He carried it out like it was a military operation. and killed and wounded 34 people in 6.5 minutes.
God.
It's hard for me to say that person was not in possession of his mental faculties. He knew everything that he was doing every step of the way. Mm-hmm. So to me, there's a very big distinction from the, you know, vampire killer mm-hmm. and someone like this, right?
It's hard for me to comment because I don't know the story and I don't know the guy, but I hear what you're saying. I understand the distinction that you're drawing for sure. So perhaps if I back up and talk a little bit about categories of mental disorder, if that might help. I don't know. Would that be okay?
Yeah.
So in old money, say 100 years ago, they had two broad categories of mental illness. So they had psychoses and neuroses. They're distinct. So today still you have psychotic disorders. A psychotic disorder is a perceptual disorder. It's a perceptor. So it's characterized by a disorder of perception. Either I see something that isn't there, or I hear things that don't exist telling me what to do. So hallucinations is one typical feature. And delusions is the other. So I'm the king of China, or you're a vampire. Right. So that's a delusional framework. So a psychotic disorder is a detachment from reality. In a Thomistic sense, you might call that a catastrophic mental illness, right? It's detached from normal perceptual processes, okay? Neuroses or neurotic disorders are more, one way of thinking about it is they're emotional disorders, okay? So depression, anxiety disorders, PTSD, obsessive compulsive disorder, they're emotional disorders. So it's a different category, really. And then you have you had the emergence of what was called borderline disorders, which have come to be known as personality disorders. Since a borderline personality disorder, for example, that the use of the term borderline was used to express that it's sort of mapped onto both an emotional disorder and a perceptual disorder. And you get it with depressed people. If people are depressed enough, they say close to delusional things, really, you know. I've worked with people, I'm working with people currently who are very severe OCD, and they're saying things that are bordering on, it almost feels like a psychotic delusion, but it isn't, because they can reason their way around it and see the fallacy of the position, you know. So, yes, for sure. I think what you're edging towards is an idea of culpability. Who's more to blame? Right. Is a person who's absolutely lost use of their faculties I'm not a moral theologian, so I wouldn't like to say, but instinctively it seems obvious that I had a friend who had a psychotic episode a few years ago, and he thought people were outside trying to come in and stab his wife to death and his child. He had a baby, a 1-year-old at the time. So he went in, he became psychotic, God bless him. And was giving a knife to his wife to protect the baby. Do you know what I mean? So you can. It's very clear that if you're psychotic, then you're not culpable for certain actions. That's for sure. If somebody isn't psychotic and they have, you know, when it comes to psychopathy, so to be a psychopath, that's not a psychotic disorder. That's a personality disorder by modern, terms. But I don't know if that sheds any light on what you're asking about.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're moving in the same direction. So now we step down from these extreme examples to depression, mm-hmm. and depression is something that a lot of people deal with and go through. Some constantly, some in and out of depression in certain circumstances and situations. So again, I'm going to start off by telling you my perception, which I fully admit could be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But my anecdotal perception has been that that depression is more often caused by life experiences and how we respond to life experiences than from some organic medical thing. I really have a hard time believing in this concept of a clinical depression, which is just, like you said, the neurons misfiring and what have you. Most people, when I hear depression categorized as a mental disorder, I have a big problem with that, because when I see people who are depressed because they lost a loved one, I would think to not be depressed in that situation would mean you were disordered. So most of the time that I see people, and I know a lot of people that use depression as a crutch because they don't want to try. They don't want to make an effort. So where am I off balance here?
Okay. So depression, for the most part, and you've said a few things, so I don't want to say I agree with what you've said necessarily, because there are some things that I do and some things that I don't in what you've said, because you've put a few things together there.
Fair enough.
I'm a psychotherapist. I used to be a psychiatric nurse, right? So I used to work in acute inpatient psychiatry with schizophrenics and bipolar and the more severe end of mental illness. And for the past 10 years, I've been working as a psychotherapist. I moved to psychotherapy because, well, I always intended that anyway. That was always the path that I, the end goal that I intended to arrive at. But the reason that I lent more towards psychotherapy than a medical treatment was because of what you said. So I would agree that depression and common mental health problems like social anxiety or health anxiety, or, you know, one in four people has a common mental health problem. Antidepressants are the most commonly prescribed medication on the face of the earth, you know. So I agree that for the most part, such difficulties are given rise to by our experiences and how we respond to our experiences. So it's nurture and not generally stemming from an organic cause. That being said, it can stem from an organic cause, but it's rare, I would say. For the most part, it's just we're not relating healthily to our own soul. We're not really our thoughts. So one of the things that I talk about in, so I've created a course called Overcoming Depression with Catholic CBT. One of the things that's identified really in modern psychology, but it, you know, it does it in a not a great way, but the way that we're thinking when we're depressed is irrational. Essentially, that was how the, in again, they used that terminology 50 years ago. That it's fallen out of favor now because it's politically incorrect to say so, but it's more accurate language. So there's something wrong with how you're thinking when you're depressed. There's something wrong with how you're behaving when you're depressed. There's something wrong with how you're relating to your emotional life when you're depressed. So there's definitely such a thing as a psychological disorder. And all that means is that there's disorder within the psyche. There's disorder within the soul. So, yeah, I would say that generally speaking, in my experience, people who are depressed because they've had very difficult experiences in their life, often in their childhood. God bless them. Most of the time, there's practically no fault. Sometimes we're depressed because I've had an affair with a lady down the road and I feel guilty. Do you know what I mean? That's, you know, sin will also darken the intellect. Sin will also weaken the will. So again, this separation of morality from psychology is just a bad idea, because we're moral creatures, right? We have a conscience, and we can do things that we consider shameful. But the majority of the time when people are depressed, when I work with them, they've been through things that they haven't known how to handle. They haven't known how to process. They haven't known how to work through. They've developed maladaptive coping mechanisms thereafter, and they don't know the way out of it. They don't know how to achieve psychological order. They don't know how to achieve peace of soul, you know? So I wouldn't go so far as saying there's no such thing. All clinical psychology means is that a doctor has said you, sorry, yeah. All clinical depression means is that a doctor has diagnosed you. That's all it means. You've met sufficient diagnostic criteria for a doctor to say, look, he's depressed. That's all that it means. But
okay. Fair enough. I can accept your explanation. So now we're going to make a segue into what you're doing. And here's how I'm going to make the segue. I'm going to take psychotherapist Greg Nolan and Catholic Greg Nolan. We're going to put this together. Okay, so psychotherapist Greg Nolan, talk to me about depression and then explain to me how that marries up with Catholic Greg Nolan and, say, St. John of the Cross, Dark Night of the Soul. So how is depression equate to the Dark Night of the Soul? Are they similar? Are they the same thing? Is there some overlap? And explain why your approach is different than what we see in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Depression isn't the Dark Night of the Soul. It just isn't. So, John of the Cross, I really liked the name of your podcast, so the four persons and the heart being one of the persons, you know. So when St. John of the Cross talks about the Dark Night of the Soul, it's a spiritual path. It's to do with spiritual union with God and the sort of denuding of the psyche of its strength and power, really. So it talks about the Dark Night of the Senses first, which is the denial of pleasure through the senses, and then the Dark Night of the Soul, which is the denial even of things that we know, in order to lay down our intellect before God, to be unified with God in contemplative silent prayer. So the Dark Night of the Soul isn't depression. So Ignatius of Loyola, for example, talks about the discernment of spirits, and he talks about consolation and desolation. And that's one of the models I use in my overcoming depression with Catholic CBT, is this idea of consolation and desolation. But when Ignatius was talking about that, he was talking about the spiritual life. He wasn't talking about the life of mental health. It just maps onto mental health really well. So you can use it. But so when he talks about spiritual desolation, that's in your prayer life, right? It's in prayer. If you're depressed outside of your prayer life, then that's not the desolation that St. Ignatius was talking about. It's not the Dark Night that St. John was talking about. That's answered the latter point first. But the first thing you said is talk about what depression is. Depression is a real mental disorder that people experience. What I'm careful about is using the term mental illness. Not that I think that mental illness is necessarily technically wrong, but I think it puts the wrong idea in people's heads. Because when you say mental illness, an illness is typically thought of as something like the flu or cancer or COPD, an illness. It's something that I have that's part of my, it's a physical disorder, right? Whereas depression is a mental disorder. It's a psychological disorder. The soul is disordered, that's for sure. And it does impact the body. So when they talk about neurotransmission, for example, that's true. It's demonstrable. When people are very depressed, they're not transmitting neurotransmitters effectively. That's clear to be shown. But the reason for that, I would say, from a Thomistic perspective, is that the Thomistic principle that the body conforms itself to the operations of the soul. So if I live in such a way as my intellect becomes darkened, my will becomes weakened, my passions take on too strong a life within me, to the point that I've got no motivation to do anything, no pleasure. So I'm in like a what you would call as an objectively depressed state. My body is going to start changing to conform to that pattern of behavior and experience, you know. So there is a, you know, due to the fact that we're a body-soul composite, if there's a disorder in my soul, that's going to have a negative effect in my body and how my body functions, even at the level of brain activity. It's certainly.
And I had a Catholic psychotherapist explain this to me years ago, and that's where we came up with the concept of the four persons. Mm-hmm. She explained to me that the emotional is going to affect the mental, is going to affect the physical, is going to affect the spiritual. They spill over onto each other. Yeah. And then, of course, I read it in Mark chapter 12, verse 30, that you shall love the Lord your God with your whole heart, your whole mind, your whole soul, mm-hmm. and your whole strength. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we came up with this. So how does your approach deal with what we typically find in terms of addressing the whole individual?
Mm-hmm. The first difference is in the starting point. Right. So the first difference is in the view of what the human person is. And you've rightly shone a light on the elements of the human person. So body and mind are distinct categories, right? So intellect, our capacity for reason, and our free will. The certain faculties of our soul, intellect and free will, that are immaterial. They're immaterial. My ability to think is distinct from brain activity. It's distinct. I've got to be careful with how I approach this. The process of thinking is a spiritual activity. The process of willing and choosing is a spiritual activity. That being said, because we're a body-soul composite, all of the knowledge that I have comes through my senses. This is the Aristotelian position that Thomas Aquinas took up later, right? This is realism. All knowledge that I have comes through my senses. I have sense impression, then I have an imagination, which is, again, that belongs to my body. The imaginative faculty is part of the body. My emotions are part of my body. My intellect and will are not part of my body. They're part of my spiritual soul. But because we have a spiritual soul and we're a body-soul composite, when I think, my brain is engaged, right? You can't separate one from the other in this life. They will be separated at the point of death. Your body will die and your spiritual soul will go on, right? So when we stand before our Blessed Lord after death, it's going to be your spiritual soul standing before our Blessed Lord, not your body. Your body will be rotting in the ground until the final resurrection. You know? So the starting point of the difference between Catholic CBT and any other secular form of psychotherapy is the understanding of the different faculties of the soul. And that goes on to affect how we think about ourselves, also how these faculties should relate to one another, what should be at the top, what shouldn't be at the top, you know? So the spiritual faculties of your soul are the higher order power. My intellect and will are a spiritual power. My intellect and will is in common with the angels. The angels are pure intellect, pure will. They have no body. They have no passions. They have no imagination. They have divinely infused knowledge. Human beings are a composite of intellect and will, which is spiritual, but body as well. So we're a composite. We're one thing, but we bear a quality in common with the angels. We bear a quality in common analogically with God, right? When it says we're made in the image and likeness of God, the church teaches that's principally in the soul, principally in the soul. And that's because we can think and reason. Our Blessed Lord is called the divine Logos. Logos is reason, right? Logos is... So the starting point is the major difference between what I do and what any proper Catholic therapist will do and what secular therapists do. So the understanding of the person, what is the person? What constitutes the powers of the psyche? What constitutes the powers of the soul? And it's really clearly stated in the writings of Thomas Aquinas. It's wonderful. You know, the writings of Thomas Aquinas are an absolute gift to the field of psychology. They're crystal clear, and it makes it so easy. It makes it so easy to utilize. So that's the starting point. What do you have there? It's blurred. I can't see it.
The Summa.
Beautiful. Wonderful. Thank God for that. Difficult to read. It's a difficult read, but
it is. It is.
Yeah. But yeah. And from that starting point, all of the treatment really is affected. Every element of the treatment is affected. So shall I go on talking about the treatment? Or?
Yeah, so let's start there. So I'm patient X, mm-hmm. and I come into you and say, hey, doctor, I've really been, you know, struggling with depression, really have a difficult time in my life. Where would you start?
Okay. So I'd start with the general process of assessment. So how long has this been happening? When did it start? Can you remember a start to it? Sometimes people say, well, I've been depressed all my life, you know? So my mind goes to formative years. So what tell me about your early years. Tell me about what you went through. Tell me about what you've experienced. It's really inquisitive. So in early days therapy, I'm doing a lot of listening. I'm asking questions to map out this person's experience, to map out. You really want to identify what's the genesis of this difficulty. So there's a distinction between a reactive difficulty. You mentioned earlier, somebody dies and they go into a grieving process and then they become depressed thereafter. The grief is different to depression, right? So that's got a clear starting point. Somebody died. I wasn't depressed before that. Some people, so we can look at, well, how have you managed since then? What have you been thinking? What have you been doing? How have you related to yourself? How have you related to other people? So you're looking at the person's life in its fullness as best you can. But if people say, well, I've sort of been depressed on and off all my life, then I want to know, I always want to know, to be honest with you, something about what went into the formation of this person's character, what went into the formation of their persona, their identity, how they relate to the world. So some people, many people, their early experiences set them up that it's just inevitable they're going to have mental health problems later. You can see it happening and you can get a feel for it when you talk to people, right? Yeah. So,
and then is that typically from people who were abused in some way as children, whether that's sexual abuse or mental abuse or physical abuse? Is that a common starting point for the people that struggle with depression all their lives?
Can be, yeah. The way that I talk about early experiences is there's two ways, broadly speaking, in which things can go wrong. The first way is what you've described, right? So something was there that shouldn't have been there. The language that I use for that is a present evil. There's a present evil in the life of the child, and that's sadly all too common. The other thing is something wasn't there that should have been there. The absence of love, the absence of affirmation, the absence of kindness, the absence of play. So, for example, if when you're born, your mother is catatonically depressed, so she's in bed for 2 years, or, you know, she's got a severe mental illness, there's no abuse, but you're not getting what you need. You know, you're not getting love, affirmation, play, tactile, being held, you know. So there's either a present evil or an absent good. They're the two ways in which things can go wrong, broadly speaking. In terms of a present evil, yeah, abuse in its various forms, addiction, if they're raised in an addicted household, just the viewing of violence, you know. Sometimes it's vicarious. You can, poor children, you know, they're raised in just very hostile environments. But broadly speaking, the way that I talk about it is there's a present evil or an absent good. If those things, they tend to present differently as people grow up, actually. So a present evil presents differently to an absent good. You see different things in the outcome of those two types. But yeah, abuse is very common. I've worked with, you know, childhood sexual abuse more times than I care to think about. It's
So you talk about a present evil or an absent good. Mm-hmm. What about, is there any difference in the case of someone who has been traumatized by something that was neither, an accident that, you know, devastated the family, you know, killed family members or something that was external, that was no one in their family or in their surroundings, you know, trauma of some sort. Is there a difference in the way that those people deal with that than the person that was in the presence of that active evil or that deprivation of good?
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, so in those cases, so for example, if you're in a house fire because of an electrical fault, that's still, I'd still call that a present evil. And so there's a distinction, for example, between a moral evil and a material evil.
I see.
Right. So a moral evil is somebody did an evil thing. Material evil is just something I suffered. A broken arm is a material evil, right?
I got you.
So it's still a suffering. A road traffic accident, road traffic accident very commonly leads to post-traumatic stress disorder. It's often nobody's fault, right? But there's this instantaneous thought, I'm going to die. And that's traumatizing. It's too much to process. So they go into shock and PTSD thereafter. So yeah, it's more fear-based then. When it rests upon a moral evil, so abuse, it's much trickier. And that generally, again, I'm thinking out loud as I'm talking here. To be honest, I'm reflecting on my experience. But there's a difference between a fear-based difficulty, such as a road traffic accident, PTSD, or I don't know. I saw my wife fall through the top of a greenhouse, and it scared me half to death. That's fear-based. When you have abuse, rape, sexual violence, it's more shame-based. It's fear and shame-based. So it really complicates the picture. That's what some writers would call interpersonal trauma, right? And that's much more difficult. Like in fear-based trauma is relatively simple to treat. Shame-based trauma is much more complicated to treat. But that would be one distinction that I would draw, but there are many.
Okay. So let's draw from just the one example that the person experienced a long chain of what you describe as moral evil for a long duration of time in their childhood. Where would you start in terms of your treatment?
For chronic childhood abuse?
Yes.
Where would you start? You'd start with assessment again. You'd want to. There's lots in it. There's too much to say, to be honest, for this in this time. But some elements. So you need to build a relationship, firstly, right? So you're talking about interpersonal abuse. You're talking about interpersonal trauma, essentially. There's a book that's very well worth reading called The Body Keeps the Score, about interpersonal trauma and sexual abuse. Have you heard of that?
No. Who is that by? And we'll make sure we put it in the show notes.
I'd have to look it up. It's Van der Kerk or something. It's a Dutch guy, works in America now. It's considered in most modern psychological circles as sort of the authority on that kind of trauma, really. Mm-hmm. But building a relationship insofar as you're able, developing trust, you know, you would need to work towards working through the traumas themselves. If it's chronic, multiple incidents of trauma over many years, again, it varies person to person. It's hard to say without a case in front of me, to be honest. In general principles, there's various elements to trauma per se. Let's talk about PTSD per se, because that's what we seem to be talking about here. Okay, so PTSD. Firstly, we'll talk about what a trauma is. All right, a trauma is an experience that I can't process, and the reason that I can't process the trauma is because the emotion is evoked so highly that the brain can't tolerate it. The brain just shuts down and says, "This is too much." Right, this is and the brain does that for us because it wants to protect us. The two emotions, typically, or passions, if they're evoked highly enough that traumatize us, are fear and shame. If I'm too frightened, I'll just shut down. I'll go into shock. It's like this, I'm not having this. And when people talk about a fear-based trauma where their physical integrity was at risk, this guy is going to kill me, or I'm going to die in this crash, they talk about dissociation. So dissociation is a big part. It's like a switching off to the experience. This isn't happening, you know. Shame-based trauma is more, this is too debased. This is too, this evokes too. With shame-based trauma, one element that's very, very key to identify is the effect that the trauma or traumas had on the person's sense of self. Who am I? Because when people are traumatized, they usually say something along the lines of, I was one person up until the trauma, and then it ruptured, and I've been a different person since, right? So you want to look at their view of themselves. You want to, what in CBT you'd call their core belief about themselves. But there's loads of elements. So there's the emotional processing of the trauma or traumas. There's the reintegration into life in the here and now, because typically somebody in PTSD, they're not engaging in life in the here and now. There's the reclaiming of life in the here and now. There's the reclaiming of the self right back to birth, right back to the point of conception. There's loads to it. Where do you start? You start with an assessment. You start with what happened. How did you respond to it? Like you would with anything, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because to be perfectly honest, a lot of this is hitting home. A lot of this is experience with my own family, and I've talked to other counselors who've kind of touched upon some of the same themes that you've talked about. For instance, borderline personality disorder. And that is that's a result of this overload that you describe, right? Where the mind just can't process or take anymore, and then the person starts to disassociate, and it's almost like they become, it's almost like the borderline is like borderline multiple personality disorder. Is that, I mean, it can be really, really destructive to people who experience these kind of things, right?
Yeah, early life trauma for sure. Personality disorders are all thought of as being born of early life experiences. So it's a maladaptive way of relating to oneself and the world around us, but born of early life. Generally, you see a lot of trauma with borderline personality disorder. But you've touched upon dissociative identity and things. So dissociation isn't necessarily, it's very rarely dissociative identity, right? But so dissociation is a response to acute anxiety. There's too much fear, right? People dissociate all the time, really, and there's particular physical reasons for that. It's to do with what happens in the body when you're frightened, essentially. But yeah.
There's lots. Now I'm gonna throw a real sticky one at you. A real sticky one at you, because this one's been thrown at me, and I think this is at the core of what we're talking about here. And this is a really sticky dilemma. It's been, again, my anecdotal experience, and you can correct me if my experience is wrong, but a lot of people in these types of situations who were once people of faith, perhaps people of great faith, lose their faith, turn away from their faith. And it's because of two great difficulties. And I'll give you both of them. And the first is, where was God in the middle of all this? Why didn't he protect me?
Yeah.
And the second is, I have to forgive. And I don't want to forgive the people who did this to me, and the people who supported it, and the people who looked the other way, and the people who didn't stop it. Mm-hmm. Those are two sticky, sticky problems, wouldn't you admit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the spiritual divorce from God is one of the greatest tragedies in human experience, you know? So one of the things that I do, that I work part of, is post-abortion work, post-abortion trauma, post-abortion depression, post-abortion syndrome. One of the features of post-abortion syndrome is spiritual divorce from God. I've got no time. I can't contact. You know, I can't go there, which is tragic. In a nutshell, the solution to the problem is reconnecting with God, right? It's moving back toward God. But you said forgiveness. Forgiveness is
a hurdle.
It's a hurdle. It's a hurdle. There's ways of approaching it, that's for sure. What was the first one? Sorry, I missed the first one. Oh, where was God? Where was God?
Where was God in the middle of all this?
Yeah. Yeah, God was right there on the cross, experiencing exactly what you experienced. You know, God is with me more than ever. This is, you know, it's that would be my instinctive response to the question, "Where was God?" God is in all. God has borne all of my suffering. The teaching of the church is that in our Lord's passion and death, he bore the spiritual wounds of the entirety of humanity. Our blessed Lord bore every rape, every mutilation, every incestuous act, everything in his flesh. Where was he? He was right there. To me, that would be, I know that it's saying it very quickly and it might seem a bit dismissive, but you know, we're not talking clinically here. This isn't necessarily how I'd say it clinically, but this is the reality. This is our faith, you know. Forgiveness Somebody asked me about that yesterday. Forgiveness is hard. It's really hard. How do I forgive? The stages to that, you know, it's misunderstood largely. Thomas Aquinas said a thing that, to me, when I heard it, it really rocked me. It was like, man, that's so important, and it has proven to be so. So there's a phrase of Thomas Aquinas. He says, "Justice without mercy is cruelty. Justice without mercy is cruelty, but mercy without justice is disintegration," which is very interesting. So justice without mercy is the man stole the apple, chop his hands off, right? That's the punishment for the crime, right? I don't care about mitigating factors. It doesn't matter. Mercy without justice is looking at the mitigating factors without actually judging the bloody evil of the thing that was done. So a lot of people feel that they're supposed to forgive, and what they interpret that as is, I shouldn't feel angry or something. I shouldn't hate the person. They're circumventing the psychological response. They're thinking that forgiveness means betraying my integrity and not feeling hate or anger. You can only forgive if you acknowledge the wound, right? If you bear the wound, part of the wound is I effing hate this person. That's part mm-hmm. of the wound, right? You can't forgive until you acknowledge the full reality of yourself and the woundedness. So in my experience, when people struggle to forgive, and I don't want to step on anyone's toes or anything. I don't know if this is touching personal things for you too much. So I'm just, again, airing my thoughts. But one problem can be that people aren't giving themselves permission to feel the fullness of their passionate life. I hate, I'm enraged. They're not allowing themselves to be. And they think that to forgive means to not, and that's a proper instinct, right? They shouldn't jettison themselves. They should fully experience themselves and do honor to themselves and their woundedness and what happened. And that is step one in forgiveness, I would say. But you're right, it's tricky. It's a tricky dilemma.
Yeah, and to answer your question, yeah, you're really hitting home with some of these things, but and that's okay, because I know there are other people that you know, have experienced this same kind of thing, and what you're saying is very, very helpful to them. Now, you brought up what St. Thomas Aquinas said that really struck you. I was really struck by what St. John of the Cross said, mm-hmm. Enumerating what you're talking about, where Jesus was right there in the midst of our suffering. And I remember when I was younger, you know, reading the scriptures and reading about when Jesus cried out from the cross, uh-huh. My God, why have you forsaken me? Uh-huh. And I remember struggling with that wait a minute. Jesus is God, so how could God cry out to God that he's forsaken by God? Mm-hmm. I really struggled with that. Mm-hmm. And the way that St. John of the Cross describes it is that in some intimate way that we can't really understand, Jesus fully immersed himself into his humanity at that point, mm-hmm. in order to totally identify with the suffering, the unique suffering of feeling like God has abandoned you, mm-hmm. In order to make that deep suffering holy and salvific, so that at the moment when you feel like God has abandoned you is actually the moment when he's closest to you. And I read that, it was like, boom.
Yeah,
that's where he was.
Praise be to God. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But again, going back to what you said, it's hard to say that to a traumatized person. They don't want to hear it.
It depends where they're at. It depends where they're at. Yeah, but you're right.
What I'm trying to understand is, and I mean, you know, we can't go into specifics on specific cases, but just in general terms, how does the process look that gets you from point A to that point? How do you work towards that?
It depends where the person is. It depends who they are. And so I now, at this point in my career, am moving my attempt, right? What I hope to do is to practice as a Catholic psychotherapist. I've worked for 20 years in the National Health Service, right? So socialized healthcare. So it's I can't even mention God, right? I haven't been able to for I left the NHS about 2 years ago now, so I'm working privately now. How do you do it? It depends where the person's coming from. Like in for example, the post-abortion work that I do, some of the people have a real living faith. They have a real living faith, so that kind of idea just isn't jarring to them at all. Some people, when they've been traumatized and you say God is with you, they're internally saying that they hate you for saying it. They hate, there's like a visceral felt. They're like, get away from me, you know? I don't want to hear that. So it depends where the person's at. So it's certainly not one size fits all, but in terms of mental health, right, in terms of being psychologically ordered, we were made for God. My soul is made for God. All of my experience, everything in my experience should be experienced, what Aquinas calls sub ratione Dei, under the aspect of God. Everything is under the aspect of God. My view of me is under the aspect of God. Well, God made me. My view of the world, God made the world. My view of evil, evil is an offense to the extrinsic glory of God, you know? So when I'm working with religious people, part of what you do in therapy is to enlighten the intellect, right? It's just to state the truth, to bring people back to the truth. If I'm not bringing people to the truth, I'm not helping them. Now, you're right that it depends on who the person that I'm working with. Some people I only by example, right? Some people, so I was on a podcast a few weeks ago and a guy said, well, how do you convey to somebody that they have worth? And I gave a fairly technical answer. And I thought afterwards, what I should have said really is you exemplify it to them. So in the relationship, you have worth for me, right? So you give an example of love, you know? And that's all some people can take. But that's very healing for people, that's for sure. And if they can see that, and if they're open to the truth, which is that I'm a creature of God, which is that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The Son became man, died for our sins, bore my wounds, bore our stripes, bore everything that I've experienced. One thing that people say when they've been traumatized is Christ didn't experience what I experienced. He was never raped. He was never, you know, molested, mutilated. Well, he was mutilated. But he bore the spiritual suffering of everything. He's experienced everything we've experienced spiritually. He's experienced the psychological traumas that we've experienced, and he didn't sin. Part of true psychotherapy, so healing of the soul, is bringing people to God. It has to be. Otherwise, it isn't actually healing the soul. It's a fake plastic version of psychotherapy. It's not genuinely fully human.
Mm-hmm. You know? To use an analogy, it's like you have a fractured leg, and the doctor just prescribes you enough morphine so you can't feel the pain without healing the fractured leg.
Yeah,
and that's an analogy, but I mean that's kind of the same thing, right?
Yeah, it's symptomatic. It's not going to the deep level, that's for sure. Absolutely. That's absolutely a clear analogy. Another one I often think of is a psychotherapist who doesn't know what the soul is. It's like a physiotherapist who doesn't know what the body is. You know, a physiotherapist is a healer of the body. That's why you study what the body is, an anatomy, and then you can do physiotherapy. Psychotherapists should study what the soul is and how it works before they do psychotherapy, you know? So, yeah.
You have... again, we touched on this lightly. You've started a program online, a self-help program online. Mm-hmm. Tell our viewers how they can access that and find more information about what it is that you're doing.
So the program is called Overcoming Depression with Catholic CBT. It's an online video series. It's hours of content. I find when I do therapy, even when I work with religious and Catholic people, the amount that they don't know is staggering. It's staggering. And I, there's lots of what you would call psychoeducation, like the, just explaining how things are really, and a lot of that can just a lot of that can be done outside of the context of psychotherapy. So it's a self-help program really, with lots of psychoeducation in it, lots of tools and strategies of what I can do in terms of my thinking, in terms of my behavior. What can I do to overcome this? Because there's lots we can do to overcome it. Where do you access it? I've just got to look for a moment. Excuse me. I can never remember my website. So I've got christian-psychotherapy.co.uk. That's christian-psychotherapy.co.uk. They can also find me on Facebook. I've got a YouTube page called Catholic CBT.
Give me that address again. I'm going to type it in the comments.
So christian-psychotherapy.co.uk. In the website, it clearly expresses Catholic, but, you know, I'm open to working with Protestants too. You know, I can work with anyone, but I want them to know where I'm coming from. And then on Facebook,
I just added that to our comments, so people can access that website.
Lovely. And then there's me on Facebook, Greg Nolan. I've got a Catholic CBT group. I've got a Catholic CBT page. I've got a Catholic CBT YouTube page. So, it's called Catholic Psychotherapy on YouTube, I think. They'll find, if they get on the website, then I'll add all those links anyway, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you have an email address?
Yeah. I've recently got a new one for this business, actually. As we were talking prior to this meeting, that I'm not the best with technology. Hang on a moment. So my email address is catholiccbt.gmail.com. Sorry, catholiccbt@gmail.com. Is that what I said?
Yep.
Yeah.
catholiccbt@gmail.com.
Yeah.
And we have also put that in the comments so people can reach out to Dr. Greg.
Thank you. I'm not a doctor, by the way. People,
oh, you're not.
I'm not a doctor, no.
Okay. Yeah. I stand corrected. You should
no
be.
No problem, yeah. Yeah, I get that.
This has been a fascinating conversation, and I hope we can bring you on again. I really, really enjoyed this, and
thank you.
This is right up our alley, and we will definitely be in touch with you and follow up and spread the word on what you're doing. I think you're doing God's work here.
Please, God. Please, God. Yeah, it's been a thorough pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for your time.
All right. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
You too. God bless. Bye-bye.